I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Another wonderful event. We're delighted to welcome Brian Dillon to talk about his new book, Affinities, published by Fitzcarraldo. I feel like there's a nice affinity between Brian and the shop, if I may say, and it's always a pleasure when you come. I had to say it. We're always very grateful when you do, so thank you so much. And thank you also to Jennifer Higgy, who's here to talk to Brian. There's just one more thing to do, and that is to give our guests a really warm welcome. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Claire, and thank you very much to the London Review of Books bookshop. It's clunky, isn't it? And it's such an honour to be here on Brian's publication day, which I'm so thrilled about. But I have to say that I'm slightly annoyed with him because I was asked to do this talk with Brian, which I was very glad to do because we've known each other for a really long time. And then I sort of blithely got the book and read it. And it's a book of such genius. And it's got so many ideas in it. And it's got so many references in it. And it goes in so many different directions. So I was a bit like, shit, this is a big job, this one. Let's launch into it. I'm sure you all know Brian, but just in case you don't, his books include Suppose a Sentence, Essayism, The Great Explosion, Objects in This Mirror, Essays, I Am Sitting in the Room, Sanctuary, Tormented Hope, 9 Hypochondriac Lives, In the Dark Room, and his writing has appeared in The Guardian, New York Times, London Review of Books, New Yorker, Freeze, etc., etc., etc. And I first met Brian when I invited him to write for Freeze magazine many years ago, more than 20 years ago, I think. It was like 2001 or something like that. And because I really loved his writing, obviously. And I thought, God, what were the things that he was writing way back then? So I had a look. And so I looked in the very dusty, it was like the Pompeii of Freeze, looking into, you know, the year 2000. And I saw that in 2001, he wrote a piece on the cultural history of zoos, title Against Nature, because at that point, Huysmans was all the rage, The Pleasure of Aphorisms and Sebald's Writing. And I was thinking, this is so wonderful that these explorations of yours have been so eclectic and beautifully eccentric, and they make extraordinary connections across time and place. But so your new book, Affinities, which is here, and look at all the post-it notes, is a book of real wonder and curiosity and questions. And it's a trilogy of sorts which follows the book's Essayism and Suppose a Sentence. Brian describes it as a collection of writings about art and artifacts that have hung around in my image repertoire, which is a Roland Barthes phrase, for years. And he examines from myriad angles why certain objects, disciplines, people, or experiences from a photograph, an artist, a sentence, a novel, a telescope, an essay, a memory, a TV show, a piece of music, or more, how they inhabit us. But not only that, how they interconnect and how one feeds the other. But at every turn, and this is one of the things that I really love about Brian's writing, he never hectors you. He never takes a position that he is right and the rest of us are wrong and he has to try and convince us. As he said, the way things, images and ideas sidled up to each other seemed to seduce one another in ways I could not or did not want to explain. And I think that's a very beautiful way of talking about the essay at its best. So I think Brian should read an introduction now, because I can witter on, but we need to hear his words. So we'll start with, I think, the first few pages of the prologue.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. And before I read, I'm just going to read the first couple of pages of the book. You're absolutely right. A little over 20 years ago, you were kind enough to be the first person who trusted me to write about art, actually. And I think initially I proposed all kinds of other stuff, essays, articles about writers, about zoos. What the hell was I thinking? about philosophy. I think I wrote a piece about photo booths, stuff like that.
That's right.
And eventually you trusted me to write about contemporary art. Mm. About 3 years before that, I had written to Jennifer when I'd finished my PhD, and I'd realized that having wanted to be an academic since I was about 15, I had finished, the PhD had cured me of being the sort of person who had a PhD. And I wrote to you, this would have been in the autumn of, I think, 99. And I wrote to you and I said, can I review this book? I think it was a book by Paul Virilio. And I was so naive and so clueless that I didn't even send you an example of my writing. And you were so kind to write back to this idiot, this postgraduate loon, and say, maybe next time just send us a sample of your writing and we'll see how we go. So thank you. Thank you for bearing with me. I'm going to read the first couple of pages. This just gives you a sort of sense of where this book started and where I thought it might be headed, what I thought this thing might be, but it wasn't, for reasons that I'm sure we'll get to, it wasn't quite. There are 10 sections, chapters, pieces that kind of punctuate the book, each of which is called Essay on Affinity. And so I'm giving you Essay on Affinity 1. I found myself frequently using the word affinity and wondered what I meant by it. An attraction, for sure, to certain objects, to certain works of art or literature, to fragments or details, moods or atmospheres inside of them. To a sentence, for instance, or an essay, but just as easily to an impression diffusing in the mind that could not be traced back to source. A fascination with this or that artist, writer, musician, filmmaker, designer, with a body or a body of work. Fascination, already finding words with which affinity has affinities. Fascination as something like, but unlike, critical interest, which has its own excitements, but remains too often at the level of knowledge, analysis, conclusions, at worst, the total boredom of having opinions. But also the way things, images, and ideas sidled up to each other, seemed to seduce one another in ways I could not or did not want to explain. So that when I wrote affinity in a piece of critical prose, maybe I was trying to point elsewhere, to a realm of the unthought, unthinkable, something unkillable by attitudes or arguments. Not a question of beauty or quality or taste, other supposedly eternal aesthetic values. Something fleeting, in fact. Affinities don't all or always last. In the end, and for reasons above, as well as others to come, something a little bit stupid. I've been writing about images for about 20 years, finding affinities rather than deploying any kind of expertise, because I'm no art historian. Still, it had felt like an education, a second training in the image after my first in the word. For a long time, I'd been saying or writing affinity, but also dreaming, never exactly conceiving, a way of thinking about art, about objects and images that belonged to artists, including the contemporary artists, whose studios I might visit and find myself staring at the pictures, not their own pictures, that they had stuck to the wall, books and artifacts on their shelves. I had thought in passing about how these, or the smartphone photographs and Notes app reading lists that the artists sent me afterwards, how they sat alongside each other in more or less oblique relations. And then, when I came to write up the encounter, my encounter with the work and with the artist, wouldn't easily translate into the language of influence, subject matter, research. Wouldn't do so, that is, if the art was of any worth. Sometimes everything explained itself too well. How to describe, as a writer, the relation it seemed these artists had with their chosen and not chosen, what's the word? Talismans, tastes, sympathies, familiars, superstitions, affinities.
That's really wonderful. And I think what's particularly beautiful about this introduction is that it is an introduction to the idea that affinity, by the end of the book, you still don't really define what affinity means to you because it means so many things. So was this realization of the connections that emerged were in fact affinities? How did that come about? So because you'd already written some of these essays and then you wrote them when you decided that the book would be affinities. So what was the evolution of them all coming together and becoming the book, Affinities?
We were just not planning our conversation, but just kind of vaguely touching on what we might say outside a moment ago. And you said, the thing about these 10 essays on affinity, Brian, is that they're all over the place, which you meant in the nicest possible fashion. Yeah. And I suppose this book, a little bit more than the last two, and I do kind of think about it, as I think you said, as the third in a sort of trilogy with the book about essays, essayism, and a book about sentences, suppose a sentence. And this one is a little more of an essay collection. It's a little more of a kind of miscellany than those books. And I suppose it comes together in two ways in my mind. The first comes out of those first two books. I realized after having written the sentence book. So my partner who's here is also a writer. And after I'd written suppose a sentence, one day I was saying to myself and to the world and to her, what are these books about? I'm actually not sure. You know, in the way that one does when you've finished a book, you don't really know what it is that you've done. And she said, quite rightly, surely they're about affinity. And I realized two things. First, that I had been totally overusing this word. And in fact, I now realize I just looked up a couple of frieze pieces from years ago. There's an essay on Helen Martin from about a decade ago that you and your colleagues gave the title Helen Martin's Intimate Affinities. So I was already over deploying this word. And so I started to wonder what I meant by it. And I guess the thing that came to mind was exactly what I tried to describe in those opening pages. It's that experience as a writer or as an art critic. When you visit, especially when you visit an artist's studio, and maybe you know the work intimately, maybe you don't, and you're kind of feeling your way around the work, but also the person. Maybe you've met the person before, but a lot of the time not. So you have this encounter, and there's a kind of moment, or I've experienced this moment so many times, where thankfully, if things are working, if the conversation is working, you break through that sort of sense that what you should be talking about is intention and influence and research and expertise. And you find yourself staring at the things that they have around them in the studio. It seemed to me that this word affinity perfectly described that thing where the artist is working surrounded by images, postcards, scraps, objects, bits of text. And these things are, constellation is such a cliched word for this, but it's a kind of pattern, unpatterned pattern. And it seemed to me that that was something I had felt my way around, but never described. But it was something that I had found myself talking about with artists and other writers, that there was something that we couldn't quite put our fingers on in terms of how we related to other people's work. And I thought, how would you describe that? How could you begin to put that in a book? And so the thing I'm trying to describe in those opening pages is I thought I could write a really, really stupid book in which I just stared kind of dumbly, like an idiot, at various artworks and tried to describe something. But I realized quite quickly that actually I wanted to write about people I had already written about and works I'd already written about. And so it became partly a kind of question of putting some pieces, some essays that were fully formed alongside thoughts that were really not formed. So the book kind of came together probably more organically than most of the things I've written. Does that make some sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
In other words, it is kind of all over the place.
Yeah. In a good way. And you talk about the history of the word affinity, and it was used, I think you write, to mean an attraction of opposites between chemical elements. And having a very unscientific brain, I don't even really know what that means. But and then you mention in his elective affinities, Goethe used the idea to think about the orbits and collisions of love. And so how did the evolution of the word itself affect your thinking? Because in a sense, that's what an artwork does as well, doesn't it? Or a piece of writing. It evolves. Its meanings change with context.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a scholar of Goethe or of the elective affinities, still less of the kind of immensely complex kind of philosophical and scientific history that kind of you can kind of tunnel back from that novel through the history of chemistry and philosophical ideas about attraction and the attraction of opposites. What kind of struck me as soon as I started to go into that material was this real ambiguity in the history. And all of this is, you know, in the OED, in the history of that word, because on the one hand, it describes historically relationships of kinship, of blood. To have an affinity means to actually be kind of physically, organically connected to something or more often to somebody. But it also means historically relationships that are not organic, not of blood, but are about the law, you know, to be affianced, you know, to be connected formally through ritual, through decision, but also through attraction. And so it's such a kind of ambiguous term. It has something to do with a kind of formality, and it has something to do with the absolute absence of that. And I suppose that seemed to me kind of a productive way to think about not only about artworks, but about how you write about these things, because you're always coming to them partly with a sense of perhaps not of expertise, but of, you know, I'm going to do the research. I'm going to take the time to look as carefully as possible, organize that looking. You know, it happens in time. It happens in a particular space. It partly has to do with language. Maybe you talk to the artist. You do the reading. Right. You do the research and you come to the writing with, in other words, bristling with intentions. And at the same time, something escapes all of that. Or if you're doing it properly, something escapes all of that and something unpredictable happens. And I guess that sense that affinity is a kind of intentional and formal relationship. And at the same time, it's this unpredictable and organic and kind of fluid and mutable process that just somehow seemed like it was a way of describing, maybe a way of describing art, and maybe there's some of the images that will relate to that in a minute, but also a way of describing writing or my experience of writing.
Could you elaborate on that a little, your experience of writing?
Maybe. I suppose writing about artworks, writing about things, right? Writing about images, writing about objects. I think that in some way, that writing about images and specifically about photographs, which is the thing that 20 years ago you first allowed me to do, and eventually you and your colleagues allowed me to write about painting, which was kind of astonishing. But mostly I've written about photography and about film and video. And writing about images is, for me, has been like a kind of training in how you write about anything about the world, about life, about things, about bodies, about places, about buildings, about experience. And I guess it's always for me that sense that what I'm, no matter how much knowledge, and for me it's frequently not much knowledge, because I think I say somewhere in the book that mostly when I write about contemporary art or about art in general, I'm not an art historian. I tend to write short things. I tend to write essays and articles and reviews. And so the experience is kind of short-lived. Maybe we'll come to this later, but I describe criticism following Oscar Wilde. Why not? As a kind of mood or a sort of huff. You know, you work yourself into a mood with the thing and you work through it and you come out the other side. So it's a short process, and often it's a matter of, could be days, it could be weeks. If you're lucky, it might be months to work on a piece. And no matter how much research you've done, no matter how much knowledge you're bringing, I'm always looking for this kind of moment where the thing starts to kind of fray around the edges, you know? It starts to get kind of blurred. And that's the moment where I have this kind of cockeyed theory of that's entirely private when I'm writing, that's to do with what I think of as the guiding metaphor. And in my head, that's what I've called it since I was probably about 18. And writing like undergrad essays. There is this thing, maybe other writers have this, I have no idea. But for me, even if I know what I'm doing, there's always this moment where I'm potentially bored by knowing what I'm doing. And I have to find this other thing that is called in my head, probably in capital letters, the guiding metaphor. And if I can find the guiding metaphor, it sounds really stupid, doesn't it?
No, it
then
doesn't.
Everything will simultaneously kind of fall apart and come together. And I'll be able, instead of making an argument or telling a story about the thing I'm writing about, I'll be able instead to conjure this metaphor on the page, to describe the thing in other terms. And frequently the metaphor feels crazy. You know, you think, no, that image doesn't look, that portrait of whoever in a photograph doesn't look like a strange blob of ectoplasm from the late 19th century. It doesn't, but somehow it does. And that's how I'm going to describe it. And that's the kind of risk with the guiding metaphor, which is now what we're calling it, I suppose, is that it might be crazy. You might be totally wrong. And you might at that point also totally lose your reader, because your reader might be unwilling to follow you into this sense that the object or the image that you're describing is also this other strange thing that's kind of weirdly mutable and mobile. So this is my experience of writing. It's at least when it's exciting, when it feels like it's working, is that having found that metaphor, you then have to do something with
it. Do you sometimes find the metaphor, but then you don't put it in the writing?
Yes.
So it's just there as a secret guide?
Yeah.
Like those meditation words you used to have to buy. What were they? Remember that?
I don't remember that. No.
I remember there was a phase of it where people would buy the word that they secretly could say to themselves.
Oh, wow.
That would make themselves. But anyway, that's another life. But I mean, it's interesting, this idea of sort of fracturing and fragments and secret guides, because throughout the book, you're often drawn to images that are created when vision is altered, like be it through a migraine or a telescope or a camera or a film lens. So you're often drawn to these images that don't reflect the world back as a particularly clear-cut or rational place. And I think on page 23, you describe this as a new way of seeing or framing the world. And so there's a very moving essay about when you first get a migraine when you're in high school, and bizarrely your teacher allows you to ride your bike home even though you can hardly see.
Yeah.
But
thank you, Mr. Roach.
Yeah, exactly. But But you know, it was a terrifying experience, but it was also an extraordinary experience because it jolted you into a new way of perceiving and experiencing the world. And so was this experience of a migraine, was it the beginning, in a sense, of you becoming a writer, do you think? I mean, is
that
too much of a leap?
It would be amazing if it was, wouldn't it? It would be wonderful. I was what, maybe 15 or 16, and I was sitting in a science class, and I was staring at the textbook in front of me, and suddenly I couldn't see the page. People who have migraines will know exactly what I'm describing. And there was this vague blob kind of floating about, and slowly over the course of about 20 minutes, it kind of crystallized. It formed into a shape, a zigzag shape, which is called a scintillating scotoma. And the scintillating scotoma sometimes pulses in your field of vision, and it dances about. It's absolutely extraordinary. And I thought I was going blind. And so, yeah, I told Mr. Roach, I think I'm going blind. I think I should probably go home.
On your bike.
And he put me on my bike, and I cycled home. And halfway home, an old man with a cane started to walk into the blob as I was heading towards him. And I thought, I really, really hope that he comes out the other side. And he did. And I got home and I said to my mother, I was trying to say I have this terrible headache, because the headache had started as I was cycling. And I said to my mother, I have a really dreadful grenade. And I had forgotten the word headache. And I went to bed and I lay there just having these amazing kind of sort of language dreams. I don't know what I just remember that there was a kind of voice going on. And then the image stuff kind of fades and the pain kicks in. And then you start having these really strange trains of thought. The more I talk about it, maybe it was the moment of becoming something, a writer. But you are completely right. There is a strand in the book that is to do with exactly this kind of, these moments where the clarity disappears and the thing in front of you, the object that is supposed to be making sense, turns into something else, turns into this either kind of blurry or jagged and mutable and sort of dancing thing. And that runs, it's obviously in the essay about migraines. It's in the essay about Julia Margaret Cameron, the great Victorian photographer, who was admired and despised during her lifetime for the blurredness, the vagueness of her images. It's there, where else is it? It's Rinko Kawauchi's contemporary.
It's in Francesca Woodman.
It's in Francesca Woodman, this amazing photograph that she took when she was 13.
Yeah, and Dora Maar.
And Dora
well.
Maar. Yeah.
John Stesiker, I mean, that's more of the cutting and pacing, and Hannah Herc, of course.
Yeah.
So the distorted image. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you talk about these monstrous transformations of faces and bodies in these works as, in some ways, the beginning of modernity as well. There's something, and I'd never thought of this before, I'd never read it before, that modernity is somehow related to this disarray of the senses. I guess that's Rambo, Arthur Rambo, you know, him talking about the importance of the senses becoming out of whack in terms of creativity. And so, there's something here. You go, you say, shall I read out this little bit? A surprising number of the essays seem to be about images, becoming otherwise, you say, in disguises and persona assumed by Claude Cahun and Francesca Woodman. And this suggestion of an interest in blurriness and imprecision is really related to modernity. Yeah, so sorry, I'm just repeating myself. Could you elaborate on that, this idea of the blur and modernity? And actually, maybe it's a good moment for you to read something about Loey Fuller, because I don't know if you all know Loey Fuller, but she was this extraordinary dancer in the early part of the 20th century who, anyway, you can describe it. You've written about her.
Well, you know about her too. I'm sure lots of people know about
Loey Fuller. We need a film now, yeah.
Loey Fuller has kind of returned to a strange kind of prominence in recent years. I first discovered her, I think at the Pompidou in that room, I don't know if this display exists in the same form these days, that was mostly kind of modernism and surrealism, and it's kind of dominated by a display of André Breton's studio. And it's all very male and it's all very predictable. Mm. And off in a corner was this tiny monitor showing this figure in this black and white film, hand-tinted in color, of a body. But was it a body? Mm. It seemed to be an abstract shape dancing, disporting itself. And it's Loie Fuller, except it's not Loie Fuller. It's one of Loie Fuller's dancers around 1896 in a costume with silks and these big, probably bamboo kind of wands that the fabric is attached to, making these extraordinary shapes. And it's called the Serpentine Dance. And it's one of the dances that Fuller and her dancers did, in which the body turns into something else. Mm. It turns into a bird, a snake, an aquatic creature, a ray of light. Mm. At one point, Fuller contacted Marie Curie and said, I want to make a dance that's about radium. Can you give me a sample of radium? And Marie Curie writes back, you are mad. You cannot do this. But she made the dance anyway, but she performs radium. Mm. She becomes radium. She becomes kind of pure energy. She's become Loie. There's films about her now. There's documentaries and at least a couple of feature movies. Four, maybe five years ago, she was a major, there's a whole section of Taylor Swift's 2018 tour devoted to a kind of like re-performance, reinterpretation of Loie Fuller's dance. I'll read the bit, shall I?
Yeah.
Okay. In the collection of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, there are 13 photographs of Fuller, taken around 1900 by an English photographer with the pleasing name of Samuel Joshua Beckett. Fuller is posed in a park or manicured grounds. She disports herself on the lawn with trees and footpath in the background. What forms, what designs does she act out? In two of the pictures, Fuller trails her acreage of white drapery behind her as she advances into the foreground, with arms and wooden or metal wands outstretched. In another image, she flings herself away from us while looking at the camera over her shoulder, grinning. She looks like a primitive aircraft coming apart, a soft, disintegrated Blériot monoplane. And in one picture, she's quite gone. The fabric truly engulfs her like flames, like petals, like a wild idea into which the real Lolo has at last been subsumed. Despite all these versions of her, Fuller's visual legacy is hard to reconstruct. As a dancer, her reputation was quickly eclipsed by those of Isadora Duncan and Nijinsky. Cinema, which has partly preserved her for us, also did a better job than she could of staging the pageant of pure movement. Her innovations in stage lighting were important, but were further developed without her name attached. Still, it's impossible to look at Beckett's photographs, her frothing, roiling fabrics, and miraculous metamorphoses suddenly stilled in the sunshine, and not to imagine a submerged sort of Fullerism at work over the past century. It survives every time cinema, for example, is seduced by matter in motion. In the several astonishing seconds it takes in Max Reinhardt's 1935 film of A Midsummer Night's Dream, the several astonishing seconds it takes Oberon's starry cape to appear on screen, or the gleaming extruded swathes of colour in Alain René's film about plastics manufacture, The Song of Styrene, in 1958. Fuller's costumes, predictably, were among the modernist motifs invoked by Lady Gaga and, as we know, Taylor Swift. But it is Fuller's vanishing into atmosphere and effect that now seems most contemporary. She might be a precursor to all artists who are enthralled to projected light and colour. She died in 1928, having performed for the last time the year before in London. Late in life, she was surrounded by her troupe, known as the Fullerettes, and looked after by her partner, the heiress Gabby Bloch. Isadora Duncan recalled visiting Fuller in Berlin and finding the inveterate hypochondriac fretted over by many beautiful young women. In 1924, the Louvre put on an exhibition about her. It seems the performances she devised became more stark and austere in her last decade. The Fullerettes mimicked a silver sea to the strains of Claude Debussy's La Mer. There was a dance that consisted of no more than a row of silver tassels held by her girls and lit by a single horizontal shaft. She had a photograph of the surface of the moon blown up and projected onto her costume. She became a pure white screen. She succumbed to pneumonia, aged 65, but the rumour in Paris was that she burned to death and that her last words had been, "The light, the light." It's extraordinary, yeah, isn't it? It really the light.
Yeah. And when we were talking about this before, we mentioned Turner, you know, that the last words Turner apparently said was, "The sun is God." God, we've really got to work on the thought of our last lines.
One of the things I realised very, very late, just after the finished copies of the book arrived, was that there's maybe half a dozen pieces in here in which people's last words are really amazing.
Right.
Julia Margaret Cameron, when she died, is supposed to have died looking out the window at the sunshine, and she looks out, the sun is streaming in, and Julia Margaret Cameron, having spent her life making these extraordinary images, says, "Beautiful," and dies.
Wow.
Probably none of it is true. Probably all of it is
apocryphal. Can you remember any of the other ones? Because they're really good.
I don't recall.
They're really good.
Okay, so anyway, answer to your question, yes, there's something to do with modernism and blurring. And it's really, really obvious in photography in that period. But probably it goes back through the 19th century. It's probably there, you know, in De Quincey. Early on in the book, there's an essay about De Quincey's writing about astronomy. And he's writing about a nebula, and what attracts him is the idea that this thing that's being described and studied and depicted, not in photography at that point, but in drawings and engravings, is also kind of escaping the scientific apparatus of the telescope and becoming this kind of gaseous, again, sort of mutable, blurred, monstrous thing, I guess. So if you're thinking about blurring and indistinction and modernism, I think that's kind of where it starts in the 1820s.
Yeah. And actually, of course, with people like Turner or the Impressionists as well, you know, the outrage that they evinced because their work wasn't seen to be clear. So this idea of clarity. You know, you talk about such a breathtaking array of subjects in the book, but you return again and again to photography, of course. And you write about photographs that hold you because they would not resolve and continue to seem excessive, obscure, or even idiotic. And I was really curious about this, and also about the fact that you've written about photography more than any other medium, I think it would be fair to say. And even your memoir is called The Dark Room. And so could you elaborate a bit on this, both the attraction that you feel towards photography and what you mean by this, images that are excessive, obscure, and idiotic?
God, I think so. I mean, let's start with idiotic. It's something I was trying to work out, because I sort of imagined we might talk about this. And I was trying the other day to think, what is that thing? I'm sort of looking through the book now, trying to find like what would be an image that, although they're very small, I can't sort of wave them about at people, but trying to figure out what would be a good example of this. It's less about particular images, maybe, that we can describe right now, and more about a kind of moment that happens when I'm looking at photographs. And, you know, you think back, I thought a lot about photography before I ever wrote about photography because my education is in literature and my particular education is in literary theory, really. And so Bart and Benjamin, you know, when I was a student, were my big heroes. And you think about that moment in Bart, in Camera Lucida, where he talks about, famously, about the punctum, the thing that kind of holds him. And I think the thing I'm describing is absolutely not that. It's something else. It's not the kind of detail that draws you in and then kind of loses you or disperses your attention. It's something else. It's something about those aspects of photography that produce monsters, visual monsters, and blurredness. My speech is becoming blurred as I try to describe the blurredness. Blur is one version of it, but I think that there are others. It's something to do with a kind of excess. And the excess might be, it might be a shape, it might be a form. That's, I think, what I mean when I'm talking about, like, you know, the guiding metaphor, back to our friend, the guiding metaphor, is that those moments where things start to look like things they absolutely cannot be and should not be. And sometimes that might be, you know, it's a form. It's like, you know, Francesca Woodman's arm, aged 13, extending into the foreground of that extraordinary photograph. And you can't see that actually the blurred hand has, you know, the cable release in her hand. That's how she's taking the photograph. It just becomes this kind of strange, monstrous blob in the foreground. So sometimes it's that, I think, that I'm thinking about or talking about or trying to kind of wrestle with. But it might equally be just a kind of texture. There's a long essay here about William Eggleston. And for me, I love William Eggleston. Who doesn't love William Eggleston? But the most exciting thing for me, and it was a really late discovery, is his video, his black and white video work, Stranded in Canton from the early 1970s, which starts with this absolutely extraordinary scene of his children, his son and daughter, coming out of a doorway. It's obviously really early in the morning. Eggleston, who's clearly been up all night, has woken the children up. They're really distressed, and they're just like yawning and sort of stretching, and really do not want to be there in front of his, you know, Sony Portapak at 5 a.m. or whatever it is. But there's something about the texture of that image that's absolutely extraordinary. And I could watch that video, quite apart from, you know, the romance of William Eggleston, the kind of outlaw photographer, you know, the drugginess and the booziness and the kind of demi-monde of that work. If people know it, it's a really amazing portrait of a kind of underground Memphis artistic and rock and roll kind of life and milieu. But much more than that, there's like this amazing kind of ghostly quality about the entire, whatever it is, 2.5 hours of that work. So I think sometimes the thing that, you know, as you said, kind of holds my attention is just, how do you account for that texture? Partly it's technological, it's to do with the medium, but it's not only that, it's something else.
So many of, I mean, all of the artists and writers and thinkers you mentioned throughout the book, they are all exploring this almost unidentifiable quality, you know, that you dig into. And at the very, in your acknowledgements, you mention Chris Marker. And of course, there are so many influences threading in and out of your book, but I know Chris Marker is a particularly big one. And obviously Chris Marker was a great sort of archaeologist of the image and the power of it, like in La Jetée, where it's all stills and then the woman blinks and it's one of the most powerful blinks you could ever experience or watch. And you say in your acknowledgements that you thank Chris Marker, and then you rather enigmatically include a quote after his name. "We all know that Irishmen have strange connections with the untold and the untouchable." Elaborate.
Elaborate. God. I mean, yeah, you're right. I was going to put an essay about Chris Marker in this book, and then I thought, I can't, because I think that although I've written about him a lot, I don't think I've ever said anything that wasn't kind of obvious about Marker. And so I took it out in the end. That quote, God, about 15 years ago, I was reviewing a book, one of the very late books of Marker's photographs, and I can't remember the title of this book now, other people may remember it. It's the book where it's entirely made of photos of the faces of young people in protests and demonstrations on Paris streets. It's absolutely amazing. And I got a copy of the book, and I wrote to, it must have been MIT Press who published it, and I said, is there any chance, Marker would then have been in his mid to late 80s, I said, is there any chance that he could be interviewed? And weirdly, they sent me his personal email address. And so I wrote straight away to Chris Marker, Christ, and he wrote back like 5 minutes later, and he said, there is no way that I can submit to an interview. I'm far too busy. I have numerous projects that I'm working on. However, if you ask me a question now, I might answer. And so I asked him all of these questions. And he was being really kind of cagey and sort of abrupt in his answers. And for some reason, I thought, if he knows that I'm Irish, he might be more amenable. Because this, I'm sorry, people, but this sometimes happens.
Yeah.
If you reveal that you are Irish, then your interview subject is somehow more amenable. I don't know what that is. And suddenly, Chris Marker was emailing me and telling me about like flying to Cuba in the 1950s and passing through Shannon Airport and drinking Irish coffees and having an amazing time. And we had this brief exchange. It went on for a few days. And I then became one of these people who was on Chris Marker's email list. And he would send you these amazing like photo montages that he'd made. Wow. It was the era of, it was still the era of the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. And he would send these amazing satirical things about George W. Bush and so on. And when my review appeared, sorry, this is a long story about Chris Marker, but when my review appeared, he emailed me. I had put a quote in it, Ezra Pound's poem in a station of the metro, the apparition of these faces in the crowd, petals on a wet black bough. And Marker suddenly emailed me and said he had been planning to use that poem as an epigraph for the book, but he decided against it because it was too pretentious. And he said, but thankfully now you have closed the circle. And then he said, we all know that Irish people have whatever that quote is. So that's so he's fantastic. Lurking, as you have very well divined, he's lurking behind the entire book because he's not just somebody who's who was capable of... you know, he's like a 17th century kind of curioso, you know. He's surrounded by these images he's patterning in these extraordinary ways. But the thing that he's really attentive to is the strange medium in between them, you know, the mystery in between them, I think. That's what that moment is in La Jetée, right? It's like the blinking, suddenly it moves, right?
Well, this is a book of great mysteries, and I've just realised it's 10-2, so we're meant to start opening up for questions. But I, at one point, I think we've run out of time, but I was going to read the first lines of the 10 essays of affinities, because I love the way that you, I'll just really do it quickly. So the very first, affinity one, I found myself frequently using the word affinity and wondered what I meant by it. Second affinity, I had been overusing the word affinity and quite forgotten the places where I'd read it in recent years. Then the third affinity, that one's about William Gass, so I won't quote that one because it goes on a bit. It's wonderful.
It goes on a bit. Thank you. Thank you, Jeff.
Affinity four, William Gass went on, not you.
He did.
Affinity four, a relation of blood or marriage, a kind of love or attraction, a species of similitude, alike entities as they move en masse. All of these meanings of affinity, more or less vernacular in nature, are present in the scientific use of the term. Beautiful. Really good, that one. Affinity 5. Goethe's elective affinities, as its translator R.J. Hollingdale points out, is an example of a narrative form that has no close equivalent in English, either in language or literature. Affinity 6. I'll side with what I can't understand in Brahms's phrase. I'll side with the possible rottenness of an object I might one day love.
That's really not great. Me. That's Wayne. That's Wayne Kestenbaum.
Affinity 7. Affinity, Affinity insults the academy. Great first sentence. Affinity 8. How to describe the matter or medium of affinity. Affinity 9. A constant suspicion, unchanged since I was a student, that nothing I write pursues an argument or is built to convince. Affinity 10. And then this becomes a partial list of things that you haven't included in the rest of the book. And I think it's the most beautiful, beautiful list, actually. And so then I went back and looked at the very first sentence. So the very first sentence is, as I've just said, I found myself frequently using the word affinity and wondered what I meant by it. And your very last sentence, which I think is also very beautiful, but I think it's a sort of really nice bookend, is the flight of pigeons from the palace.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. I think that's really
that
beautiful.
That is it.
That's a really great last sentence.
Again, that's not me. That's Donald Barthelme.
Oh, well, it works very well. And so I think that what I'm struggling to say is that it's very hard to sum this book up because it is so full of riches and allusions and references and images and ideas and memoirs and pieces of culture. So anyway, I've done a hopeless job. What you have to do is read the book and then you'll know. So now we have, if anyone has any questions.
Another term that comes up more than once is mood. I think in Affinity 9, when you've worried about whether your writing goes away from reason, you seem to worry that it goes towards mood. Mm. So I guess just in that light, I'm wondering, firstly, what mood means to you, maybe particularly about writing about art, and secondly, why you might feel suspicious of it.
Mm. Suspicious of it?
Yeah.
Interesting. Maybe suspicious of it because... I mean, we've talked a lot about, you know, the attractions of blurred and monstrous and unpredictable forms and states of mind or being and so on. But my experience writing is also always a kind of, I don't know, I suppose it's the sort of editorial, critical superego that wants you to make sense, right? And so the idea at the same time that writing anything is just kind of getting yourself in the mood, right, to write, but also getting yourself in a mood with the thing that you're writing about. Mm. And you just kind of pursue that until you've done the other thing, fulfilled the responsibility. And the two things are always kind of working together, but in some kind of tension. The mood stuff comes partly from Wilde, from The Critic as Artist, this amazing essay in the form of a kind of mock philosophical dialogue, which is most famous for the line that goes something like, God, I've forgotten it now. Do you remember? It's the stuff about how... It's entirely gone, about how criticism is... Oh, it's coming back to me. It's the anti-Matthew Arnold line. The task of the critic is to see the object as in itself it really is not. That's Oscar Wilde's position. But there's this whole other theory in that essay that is about mood and about how critical writing is a mood. And the thing about a mood is you get into it, but you also get out of it. And once you've got out of it, it's gone. It's disappeared. And I love that idea. I mean, obviously, it's a Wildean notion that critical writing is an ephemeral form. And I suppose that's the thing with mood is that it's, and this, I suppose, is the experience, is that it's totally absorbing while you're in it. But there's also a deadline, you know. It's partly practical. There's also a deadline. But that's also essential to the whole thing, is that you work your way through the mood, and then you're done because you have to make this thing. Mm. Does that make some sense? It's just, it's the mood is one part of this scenario, this scene, and controlling the mood, you know, putting a frame around the mood, putting a shape on it, putting, giving it an end point. That's kind of partly the struggle, I suppose, in any kind of writing.
Mm. Any other questions?
Sorry, I'm still sort of thinking through the question as I'm about to ask. I guess I just wonder, having not read the book and just going off what Affinity sounds like to me, I wonder, did you think much about how intimacy works with Affinity and when you go through these moods of affiliation, how are you balancing and navigating your critical work and then your sort of like natural love or kind of, I don't know, like how is that something you're navigating when you're writing about how you affiliate and how much is that impressing on your love for said writer or photograph?
Yeah.
And vice versa. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. I think that that's kind of exactly, I mean, that's also partly what the mood is. It's a mood of infatuation and a kind of love. And I was thinking about this the other day. I just did the first sort of interview for a magazine about this book, and somebody asked kind of similar question, and I was thinking about a piece that I wrote last year, or at least this is like my most recent experience of how far this kind of sometimes goes, where I was writing about the music of Nico. It was for I don't know, the New Yorker, I think, for the New Yorker online or something, and I spent months and months and months just listening to Nico, and I realized that after about 3 months of just listening to Nico, that I never wanted to listen to anything ever again. But that if I were to survive, I would have to stop listening to Nico. And I guess that's when you know it's really working, right? Is that you're so trapped inside this relationship with this, it's not just a body of work. And I suppose this is something that we haven't really talked about. A lot of these pieces are, in a way, sort of surprisingly to me, biographical. Mm. And actually, I really, really like the challenge when you're writing about an artist, the same with writers, to try and describe to an audience that doesn't necessarily know the work at all, right? So some of these pieces are written for like contexts where you know the readers probably are coming fresh to the work. So you actually have to say quite a lot about the life as well. You're trying to give a kind of context. And in some like specialist contexts, in some, you know, art magazines and journals, you absolutely might not do that at all. Mm. Though you might, you do it wonderfully, for example. Yeah. But a lot of art critics, you know, that's not kind of on the, it's not part of the task. And so I think some of that intimacy comes with, you know, when I was younger, and kind of very caught up in the kind of theoretical notion that somehow the life was irrelevant to the work, I would have despised some of the things that I now find myself just sort of mooning over, you know, when I think about somebody's work. And now that seems absolutely essential, that sort of intimacy, as you're describing it. But then it's also an intimacy that comes to an end. And sometimes it's an intimacy with dead people. And that's so fascinating, you know, when you think about it, as writers and critics, people who write about not just contemporary work, but who write about like historical work, write about an artist or a filmmaker or a writer or whatever, that sense that you're also communing, sidling up to, somehow trying to kind of seduce the dead, is really peculiar when you start to think about it. So there isn't a sort of answer in a way to your question, other than to sort of say, yeah, all of that is kind of going on in there, if that makes sense.
Mm. Yeah.
Hi. So there's an amazing bit in one of the essays where you're a young academic and you give a paper and then some other bright young academic sticks his hand up and says, is this not just one correspondence after another without an argument? And I recognise the sort of nightmare of that feeling. But I wondered, is there a fear attached to that of what you think that the affinity approach might not be able to contain? Or do you think it's such a fluid form that you can contain whatever you want inside it?
Yeah, good question. Yes, so for those who haven't read the book, it's a very brief kind of section in one of the essays on affinity where I was 25 and I was giving my first ever academic paper in front of an audience at the university where I was doing my PhD. And I described what I thought was this relationship between an essay by, God, who was it by? Siegfried Krakauer about photography. And bits of Proust and bits of Virginia Woolf and bits of my own memory of like my family and my parents who had died when I was quite young. And I set all of these things in what I thought was this kind of beautiful pattern. And then this guy put his hand up. He perfectly nice person, but he put his hand up and he said, isn't this just a series of correspondences? You've just set these things alongside each other. Where is an argument? Where is a kind of hierarchy? Where is history? Where are the connections? And I guess you're absolutely right. There is this kind of fear, and I think it's a justified fear, that a critical approach that is mostly based on a kind of rapture is not adequate, but it may be what some of us have, if you see what I mean, you know? And I suppose I think you quoted this, Jennifer, earlier, that I'm always afraid that I'm not, in fact, capable of making arguments in writing. I'm not really capable of telling stories, and I'm not capable of making arguments. What does that leave you with? Not much, except the kind of hunch that might be if you set one thing alongside another, the things will make an argument. The things will make, but it's out of your control to some degree.
I mean, that's what Susan Sontag was talking about in Against Interpretation, wasn't she? She would have come to your defence, I think.
Would she?
Yes.
I'm not sure. Yes. She might have looked sternly upon me.
No, because you allow the objects themselves.
Yeah, but she does say something really interesting in her diaries. She says that she's not interested or she's not capable. And I think that, you know, if you're not capable, it's a good idea to be not interested, right? I mean, you play to your weaknesses. She says she's not interested in convincing a reader. She puts her essays into the world not to convince, but to have an effect. And I suppose that's the thing. That's like the difference that... I mean, this is in a way, a kind of self-consoling thing to say because, you know, Sontag agrees with us. Great. But, you know, Barthes says somewhere, I think it's in the sort of autobiography, he says, to substitute metaphor for the concept to write. And that notion that somehow instead of mounting the argument, you present the image, I mean, in writing. This isn't an answer to your question in the sense of like, how do you deal with the fact of all the other stuff that this kind of writing is incapable of doing, except maybe to say, I'm very happy that there are people who are more theoretical or more polemical or more historically minded critics, but you find the thing that you can do. And if you're lucky, you find that the thing you can do is a thing that you can pursue and you know, you can recognize that it's a limitation, but kind of mine the thin seam that you've got, if that makes sense.
Thank you so much. You've said so many incredibly interesting things this evening and on the page, so thank you for sharing all of that with everyone in the room. My question is really to do with something that you were saying about how you come to the work with a metaphor, with an idea, and how something else emerges through process. And then the question that I'm trying to tease out in real time, and I apologize for that, is between that and where you touched on not wanting to write about Marker because that was obvious, and that you might lose, and the idea of wanting, of possibly losing your reader in another set of thoughts. Yeah. But and it's that part that I was really interested in. Is that something you're seeking to engage with, the possibility that you might lose your reader? And is that the hook or the moment where you realize this might have a value for me as my biography or something for, if I fully commit to it? Don't know how much sense that made.
I'm not sure if I'm grasping the question properly.
Is it interesting to you if as a writer, if you think that you might lose us unless you fully go through that? Might be projecting, and it might be nothing. I wondered about the biographical suggestions that you said, how the image was, writing about the image was good training for writing about life.
Yeah.
And that was a real hook for me. Are you examining your own life, your own excess or obscure moments, and thinking that might lose a reader, but I think this is really interesting?
One of the things that we haven't touched on, actually, is the fact that there's a couple of essays in this, and there's probably several pieces that do this more subtly, that are kind of directly, more or less, kind of directly personal or autobiographical. And one of them is an essay about an aunt of mine who spent a lot of her life in a kind of dispute with her next door neighbors about boundaries. And she spent decades photographing the boundaries in her back and front garden. She was a very difficult person, and it's also a very kind of difficult life to think about what she was reduced to in this period. And that piece, alongside a couple of other sort of more personal essays, to use kind of weak phrase, are in there, I suppose, to acknowledge the fact that even in the pieces that are obviously not about me, are obviously not risking very much in terms of a kind of first person or a kind of autobiographical intimacy, but it's nonetheless there. And I think, I don't know, do you think? I think it sort of surfaces here and there. So I think that I am probably often afraid of losing the reader by being a bit too intimate or embarrassing myself. I think I'm always, as a writer, slightly anxious about loss of control. And that in itself is a limitation that I think I've learned to live with, because there are also these moments where I can allow something else, something messier and something more personal, to kind of drift in. And I think that it's really important, or it has been important to me, to kind of own up to the contradictions and the limitations in your own writing, because that's the style, that's the way you do stuff. I'm never going to be the person who just gives you the personal story, and I'm never going to be the person who gives you just the absolutely rational, critical, you know, intended and controlled version of things. I'm always going to be kind of playing one thing up against the other. Is that sort of answering?
No. I mean, I love the dynamic in your book between the personal and the less personal. You know, I think that it's like a piece of music, that you have these moments of real intimacy, and then you have these sort of intellectual explosions, and then you have something cooler and more speculative. You know, I think in terms of the rhythm of the book, the episodes, the personal episodes, mm-hmm. are brilliant. Like, I loved the essay about your aunt. I thought it was extraordinary. Snipping the heads off the roses and then accusing the neighbor. Amazing.
But, look what the bastards have done. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an amazing essay. Yeah. And also, it gives a greater resonance to your thoughts, say, on photography, when you've talked about the misuse of photography by your aunt, for example. You know,
Or use, you know, it's like a personal project that lasted...
Well, that was accusatory,
decades.
I guess. Yeah.
And the end of that piece, which some people have read, actually, and thought was kind of snide or, you know, overly kind of harsh or judgmental. But surely anybody who has, you know, families knows what it's like to find those people frustrating and impossible. But the point of it at the end is to say, she's just like me, you know. She just keeps staring at things and trying to control them by taking photographs of them and organizing these things. And so it's partly a kind of essay about a sort of familial inheritance of dysfunctional attention, you know. And sometimes that produces... the horror of like living out your last few decades, like absolutely paranoid. And sometimes it means you get to write stuff, you know, you get to write books. So.
Because again, this is coming out slightly uninformed and I haven't had the luxury of reading your book yet. I just wanted to finish the last 2 points, say that I actually found it delightful to almost as a reader be given the permission to think in a way that was empathetic and allowed for personal reactions to a work of art. And I think that's something that a lot of critical writing does not allow. My actual question, though, was thinking about the past and understanding your approach to writing about something that's not in the present, and whether you saw there's a certain nature of art historical writing, which is about applying critical thought, applying logical argument to sort of create this artificial impression of the conditions in which artwork was created and then appreciated. And I just wondered how much room for the sort of involuntary, the empathetic side of affinity that you describe you felt there was in art historical writing, and whether you tried it or, you know, how, whether you'd been able to take yourself to it.
I think it's an immensely complex question that has been, I mean, only partly answered by art historians themselves in thinking about what happened. I mean, obviously, I have nothing but, you know, the greatest respect for art historians and for, you know, the different iterations of that historically. And I'm really interested in the fact that many art historians have thought hard about what happens when you look at the past and think you're seeing something from now, right? Or, well, there is a whole body of work of thinking about, you know, I mean, classically in art history, it's a mistake to look at works, images, or objects from different periods and think that because you're seeing the same forms, you're seeing an affinity, you're seeing a likeness, you're seeing a continuity. Because those things, as you've said, arise at specific historical moments, they come out of particular contexts of making and of understanding, of appreciating, etc. That kind of anachronism, on the other hand, is also totally essential to the moment where you look at something from the past. And it's essential to how you look at the present too. We only, you know, those things are always playing, are always in some kind of violent conflict. Seeing an object or an image from the 1860s, let's say, with Julia Margaret Cameron, and seeing that it is has nothing to do with Francesca Woodman. Its blurs are different blurs. And at the same time, knowing that it absolutely has something to do with Francesca Woodman. So I think it's a point of like tension, and that tension never goes away. And the fact that you want the kind of mysterious connection between one point in time or history and another doesn't mean that you disrespect or ignore the historical specificity. If that is that just fudging the answer? It is in a way, but I think that it's a constant kind of, you know, tension between those things.
Jennifer Higgy, thank you. Brian Dillon, thank you so much. Thank you all for coming. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.